Welcome to the podcast of Focus 580, featuring interviews with newsmakers and experts on international affairs and daily life, hosted by David Inge at WILL Radio, Urbana, Illinois. Please support this service by becoming a member and visit us on the web at will.uiuc.edu.
This is Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the show, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Henry Frain, is at the controls. In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking about the life of America's first millionaire black movie star. His name was Lincoln Perry. He was the highest paid and the most popular black comedian in America during Hollywood's golden age. It would not surprise me, though, if you would not recognize his name. However, I'm sure that you will know him for his stage name. Lincoln Perry was Stephen Fetchett. And he is a very complex and controversial figure because some people would make the argument that he was, in fact, a pioneering hero in black cinema, as someone who should be acknowledged for having opened the door to many other African Americans in Hollywood. At the same time, there are people who would condemn him, who did during the time that he was alive and working, and still do, for embodying a vicious, nasty, negative stereotype of the black man. This morning, we'll be talking with the author of a new biography of Stephen Fetchett. The book is entitled Stephen Fetchett, The Life and Times of Lincoln Perry, and our guest is Mel Watkins. He's a former editor and writer for the New York Times Book Review, and his book is just recently published and been out for a couple of months now. It's published by Pantheon Books, and I'm sure that you can find it in the bookstore if you're interested in taking a look at it, and it is a fascinating story. Questions, too, here are welcome on the program. If you'd like to call in, be a part of the conversation, the number is 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one's good anywhere that you can hear us. That is 800-222-9455, 333-WILL. That's for, again, here for Champaign-Urbana, where we are, and toll-free 800-222-WILL. At any point here, people are interested in being a part of the conversation, you can give us a call and do that. All we ask of people, however, people who call in, just is that they try to be brief and keep their comments brief so that we can keep our program moving and get in as many people as possible. But, of course, anyone's welcome to call. Mr. Watkins, hello.
Good morning.
Thank you for talking with us. I'm fine. Thank you. And yourself?
I'm terrific.
Good. You know, going into this program, I guess I would have said that I had a pretty good idea who Stephen Fetchett was, at least the character that he created on the screen. But then, you know, as I thought more about it, and as I looked at the list of his films, I began to question whether, in fact, I have actually ever seen him, if I have ever seen any movies that he was in. And I start to wonder whether how many of people who would tell you they knew who Stephen Fetchett was, and particularly who would be critical of him as for embodying this racial stereotype, maybe actually have never seen him.
I think that's probably true. Most of his films at this point have been either put on the shelf, or his scenes have been deleted from at least some of the more notorious scenes have been deleted, so that it's very difficult to get any real sense of who he was and what he did. Many people, in fact, mistake him for another actor who looked like him and who, in fact, was brought into Hollywood to play the roles that he had been playing, an actor named Willie Bess, and many people think that that's Stephen Fetchett. Some people even think Mantan Moreland is Stephen Fetchett, and although they look nothing alike, but they played, again, the comic servant roles that were very popular during the late 1920s, 30s, and 1940s in this country.
Yeah. And given the fact that there were at least a couple of other actors, black actors, who played similar kinds of roles, it seems... you wonder why it is that Lincoln Perry seems to have gotten so much heat and perhaps less so than those other performers. Now, maybe because he was the one who helped to establish that kind of character in a sense, and that the other people who came along, in part, they were doing Lincoln Perry. So maybe that's the reason. But it does seem to be the case that he's gotten more criticism for that, for doing that kind of role than other actors that did something like that.
I think that's absolutely true, and I think the answer is a two-part answer. First, it's the simple resonance of that name, Stephen Fetchett. It's not a name that we're likely to forget, since it embodies in a very graphic and vivid way what the character was all about. Many of the other actors didn't have names like that, and we forget them, people like George Reed or even Mantan Moreland or Willie Best. Those are names that don't quite stick with us. They don't have the impact. But Stephen Fetchett says something about the character itself. And the second part was that, quite frankly, he was much better at the roles. He was a better actor, and he was a bigger star during his time than any of them ever hoped to be, in a way, I guess, because Stephen Fetchett was actually the first black movie star.
Yeah. Something else you just touch on, and I think that's really interesting, and something that perhaps set him apart from other actors. Apparently, he was indeed a very talented actor, very accomplished, and that there was something about his performances that were very mysterious, in the sense that he didn't look like he was acting.
No, he was able to take on the persona of that character in such a way that it was spellbinding when you saw it on the screen. I mean, he was actually mesmerizing, and many of the actors who starred with him or performed in films with him complained about the fact that he stole practically every scene that he was in. Mm. His timing was such, his ability to twist his body into almost this deformed-looking character was such that he became the focus of anyone who looked at the films. If you look at some of the roles, in fact, there's a still of him from Carolina with Lionel Barrymore, in which he looks almost like Quasimodo. He is so twisted and bent over and stooped that it becomes almost, in fact, it is such a distorted caricature that it's hard to keep your eyes off it, and you wonder what was he doing and how did he even achieve that kind of body disfiguration on screen. So that he simply was quite good at what he did. And if you see other photos of him as a vaudeville star, the man was almost 6 feet tall. He stood erect. He spoke in a very articulate fashion. And you wouldn't recognize him if you saw him outside of the roles that he played on screen.
Well, and I think that's probably a very important point. That is the in his real life, the kind of person that he was completely, totally
yes,
different from this character that he embodied on the screen.
Yeah, so there was nothing similar about it. In fact, he attempted to, and to a great extent did, live the life of the larger-than-life Hollywood stars of that time. And I'm talking about people like Charlie Chaplin and Mae West, various actors who were making millions of dollars at that point and were living lavish lives in the Hollywood Hills, and lived even more flamboyantly than Stephen Fetchett did. But Stephen Fetchett was known for his flamboyant lifestyle, and he did it purposefully, because he wanted to prove something about blacks being stars, and he wanted to prove something about the equality of black actors and their sense of entitlement to the same treatment that white actors receive.
Mm-hmm. Our guest in this part of Focus 580, just let me introduce very quickly again, is Mel Watkins. He's a former editor and writer for the New York Times Book Review, and he is the author of a recently published biography of Lincoln Perry, the black film actor who was Stephen Fetchett. And the book is entitled Stephen Fetchett, The Life and Times of Lincoln Perry. It's published by Pantheon. We do have a caller here, and would welcome others. Other folks want to be a part of the conversation, you can do that by calling us, 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. We have someone here over in Indiana to start us off. Line number 4, toll free line. Hello.
Hello. Luckily, I have some films with Lincoln Perry. And I remember just when I started going to the movies, I'm 66, I just got sort of the tail end of his Stephen Fetchett days. And then things changed basically to Willie Best. I remember at the time sinking in my seat in embarrassment when I first saw his acting. Then later on, I noticed that he had some interesting lines that if people paid attention to their import. And then later on, when I started collecting films from the 20s, 30s, and 40s, I had some of his I got, and several with Willie Best in different, in different movies at least, in different genres, you know, mystery and light drama and comedy. But I noticed that he had a lot more lines that were telling to the situation, like, I remember one time I said to myself, well, you dumb white boy, you do this. And he went ahead and did it, you know, and I started thinking there was a crack in there somewhere. I didn't know whether things were being, you know, sort of gotten under the door or whether the writers were using this situation to make comments themselves about the worth of the black person. I just wonder if you could speak to that, if it's just me coming off a wall with something, or perhaps there is actually something there. Thanks a lot.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, I think, first of all, you're very perceptive. I think that when you mention the writers, that struck my mind. First of all, Stepan Fetchit would often not speak the lines that writers gave him. And the mumbling that you hear, the stylized mumbling that he did on screen was something that he invented to cover up the lines. In fact, he often said that, or he later said that if he had read the lines that the way they were written, that they would have been more embarrassing than what he did when people started to complain about his mumbling. But yes, there were things that he inserted into the script. He would spontaneously insert lines into the script because much of what he did was sort of what actors call what black actors have come to call mumbling under the breath, which was all that they could do at that time because the proscriptions of the society in terms of race did not allow for any actor to clearly say something that was that indicated they stepped out of line, that they'd stepped out of their place as black men in the society. But they could mumble things that were fairly were almost indecipherable. And he often did this, and he would add those lines himself. He would also cut the lines that the writers had wrote and only say the things that he wanted to say, and this led to many problems on the set for him. He was fired for many movies for this, and he refused to say or to speak many of the lines that were written for him. There are various situations, though, where he spoke out, and particularly in Will Rogers' films, because Will Rogers tended to be a liberal and tended to sympathize with the predicament of blacks in this country. And I think of one line from Judge Priest in particular where they're talking about marching in a parade, and Stepan Fetchit says something about marching through Atlanta, referring to the North in the Civil War. And Will Rogers says that, indicates quickly that, I kept you from a lynching already. If you say that, you're going to get lynched again. And basically, these kind of lines were snuck into the film, so the caller is absolutely right. He did all that he could, given the circumstances, to present some material that really belittled or was in contrast to the character that he played. Basically, it was in contrast to the character he played. So he was demonstrating to the audience that even though I'm playing this character, there's another message here. And he often got away with it in films because of the very fact that he mumbled all of his lines and that he would say things under his breath and he would go off on his own and just say whatever he wanted to say. And some of it was cut, some of it was not cut, but much of it got through. And that's what the caller is talking about.
So you would say that that Lincoln Perry thought, in some way, Lincoln Perry thought that that what he was doing was ironic.
Yes, it
in
was.
A sense.
I mean, he was forced. I guess we have to go back and look at the situation. There was no other parts for blacks to play at that time. He did not choose the parts that he wanted to play. The roles for blacks were limited, and they were limited to servants' roles, basically. In fact, one Fox studio executive in 1929 came out shortly after the Stepan Fetchit appeared in Hearts and Dixie. One Fox executive came out and said that it is impossible for Hollywood to portray blacks as normal upstanding citizens in movies because the South would not stand for it. So they had to be portrayed in a certain way, is basically what the Fox executive was saying. And given that situation, all of the roles fell within that range. So if Stephen Fretchett wanted, and he obviously did, he was a very ambitious man, wanted to be a star, then he had to take those roles and try to extend them, to expand them in whatever way he could. And that's what he tried to do. And some of it is quite funny, as the line from Judge Priest, for instance, which, as I said, it started off by, why don't we whistle Dixie, and instead Stephen Fretchett says, no, why don't we go and pretend we're marching through Atlanta. So you get this kind of contrast, this crazy contrast that's going on. And on the one hand, he's playing this submissive, inept, apparently stupid character. But yet if you listen closely to what's being said, occasionally the opposite perception comes through in the films because he's been able to sneak something in.
His first, the first film that really got him noticed, that started out his career, was a musical with an all-black cast. And there was this point in Hollywood where they were making some movies like this. Apparently they thought there was potential for black audiences to go see these movies. And one of the things that Lincoln Perry said, among the many things no doubt that he said had got him in trouble, was he said he would rather work in a movie where the cast was beside him, where almost everybody was white, rather than to be in one of these movies that had an all-black cast. Obviously, he wanted to be noticed. He wanted to stand out. He obviously felt that put him in a position to make some kind of a statement or to do something that he could not have done in one of these movies where all of the performers were black.
Yes, that statement is a very controversial one by him, and I think it gives us a view of the complexity of the man, because basically Stephen Fretchett was a very ambitious actor. His interest was basically self-interest, and in some ways, when I compare him to Jack Johnson in the book, that's what I'm getting at, because Jack Johnson also was very much interested in being himself, in being an individual. He was not necessarily working from a racial point of view or trying to lead the race onto to higher goals. He was basically working for himself. His ambition was it was self-interest. Stephen Fretchett was much the same. He was a very ambitious, determined person. He wanted to be a star. And I think that statement comes from the fact, or that statement really comes from his sense that he had a better chance of being a star in films, in feature films, in which he was portraying a black among other whites, because those were feature films. The black film that you're talking about, Hearts and Dixie, which came out in 1929, was about his fourth film. His real breakthrough was in a silent film in Old Kentucky in 1927. But Hearts and Dixie put him over the top and made him a national figure. And that was one of two all-black films that came out that year. And it was a time when Hollywood had suddenly discovered sound movies had come out, and Hollywood was under the impression that black voices might be better on the screen because they had more resonance, and therefore they did two black films. They didn't do that again for some time. But the statement that Stephen Fretchett made was an attempt on his part to show that he could perform better, that he could stand out more, as you say, in a film where he was not, or where he was the only black in the film. And he had objected many times to this. So, but it comes back to again, this is a very ambitious man. He was not a guy who was working for the progress of the race. He was a man who was working for his own self-interest. But in so doing, he happened to make the breakthroughs that allowed other blacks to come through later. So it was that kind of thing. We have to remember also that Stephen Fretchett was West Indian, or that Lincoln Perry was West Indian. And like Burt Williams, the only other superstar, black superstar of that period, or they were both West Indians. So they came to the situation with a slightly outsider point of view. They did not have the same baggage that many African Americans had at that time about race and about a sense of inferiority. Stephen Fretchett truly believed that he was the equal of everyone. He didn't buy into the inferiority that sense of inferiority that many African Americans had unconsciously assumed at that time in this country. He felt that he was the equal of anyone, and he acted out of that that internal feeling, that unconscious feeling.
He, Lincoln Perry, and the character certainly came in for a lot of criticism from African Americans in the civil rights era and in the era of emerging black consciousness.
Yes.
Great deal of criticism for that character. If you look back to the time when Lincoln Perry was making these movies, say the 20s and the 30s, what did African Americans of his time think about Stephen Fetchit?
And that's the other thing that I try to point out in the book, that Lincoln Perry and the character he created, Stephen Fetchit, have to be looked at within the context of that time. Mm-hmm. And at that point in history, that character was a character that was being portrayed on stage and in carnivals and in various cabarets throughout this country by hundreds of other black comedians. If you even look at Oscar Micheaux films, all black films that were supposedly dedicated to uplifting the race, there would always be one cabaret scene with two comics in blackface who were basically doing some rendition of the same kind of comedy that Stephen Fetchit did. Stephen Fetchit had taken it and pushed it and made it his own in a different way. But that kind of character was looked at and laughed at by blacks across the country at that time, working class blacks in particular. The resentment came from the very small middle class that existed at that time. And what we have to remember is that 99% of blacks at that point were working class or out of work entirely, because you're talking about the Depression after in the 30s, and second, so blacks suffered more during that time than most other people. But the roles in real life that blacks had were basically servant roles. Those were the jobs that they were able to get. So what Stephen Fetchit was portraying was something very real, and blacks who went to theaters, all black theaters, to watch those kind of comics work, understood the irony of the character that's being portrayed. It's really based on an old slave ruse of what was called putting on old massa, which was pretending to be either inept, stupid, or tired or sick in order to avoid work. And Stephen Fetchit just took it one more level and did it so brilliantly, actually, and so vividly that it becomes almost surreal, and that's why he was so good on the screen with it. Because on stage, he would have had to, and he did in his stage act, be more articulate. He had to have more jokes involved in the act when he was on stage. But when he was playing a part in the movies, it worked perfectly. It fit perfectly into America's perception of what blacks were supposed to be, and into what blacks understood to be a running joke, that is the black working class. And we're talking about then the transition in history, because when you get into the 30s and 40s, and certainly at World War II, when blacks started coming back from the war, there was a much more militant thrust in the black community. And those old paradigms, those old caricatures, were now being denounced. So that when the NAACP started to move towards improving the image of blacks on screen, that was the first thing they wanted gone. They wanted portrayals of blacks who were middle class, who were working in offices, who were clerical, to demonstrate that blacks didn't have to be in these servile positions in real life.
Our guest in this part of Focus is Mel Watkins. He's former editor and writer for the New York Times Book Review. He's the author of Dancing with Strangers and the highly acclaimed On the Real Side, A History of African-American Comedy. He makes his home in New York City. And he is the author of a new biography of America's first black movie star, Lincoln Perry. The book is titled Stephen Fetchit, The Life and Times of Lincoln Perry, and it's published by Pantheon. It's out now in the bookstore. Questions welcome. We have, in fact, several people here ready to be into the conversation. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. First, we'll talk with someone in Savoy, not too far away from here, line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Back in the 30s, when I was a little girl, in the late 30s, I shook hands with Stephen Fetchit. I was born and raised in Tulsa, Oklahoma, where he lived, And my father was campaigning for statewide office at that time, and he always campaigned in the black neighborhoods. And I remember one time he took us to Mass at St. Monica's Church, which Step and Fetch had attended. And Step and Fetch had apparently knew my father, and my father introduced him to his family, and he shook hands with us all. And, of course, we all knew who he was. He was famous in Tulsa because I had seen him in the Will Rogers movie, Steamboat Round the Bend.
Uh-huh.
And Will Rogers being another local celebrity, everybody knew who Step and Fetch it was, and we were so proud to meet him, and he was quite a celebrity at that time. I don't know when he left Tulsa, but everybody knew that he was a citizen of the city.
Hmm. He was a huge star, yes.
And we had heard that he came from Arkansas, that he had been in an orphanage in Arkansas, in a Catholic orphanage. And I don't know where he was born and raised, but apparently as a youth he was at Subiaco, I think it was.
I'm not sure that that's actually true. Is that, Mr. Watkins? He was born in Florida.
He was born actually in Key West. And then his family, his mother died at an early age, and they had moved to Tampa, Florida. And then after his mother died, he was in a Catholic boys' school in Montgomery, Alabama, actually.
Oh.
That was the real background on that. But the thing about Step and Fetch, one of the most delightful things that I discovered when doing research for the book is the fact that he told so many different stories about his life. He was ultimately a trickster. He loved playing tricks on the public. He was a nice guy. He was a funny man. He was, as I said, an ambitious and determined man. But he also constantly rewrote his background, depending on who he was talking to. So it was very difficult when doing the book to figure out what was true and what was not true, because there are at least six different versions of every tale that he told.
Well,
and he is on record as having said these things.
I'm interested in how you came to be interested in him. Most blacks today or in recent times never heard of him, and have no interest in him whatsoever. And I was just wondering what a white author from New York.
Well, first of all, I'm not white.
You aren't.
No, no, I'm black. In fact, I'm from your part of the country. I'm from Youngstown, Ohio, actually. But I've moved to New York and I've been here since I went after college when I started working for the Times. But the reason I started writing about him is because I did another book called On the Real Side: The History of African American Comedy.
Oh.
And in that book, which is a very long book which traces the entire history of comic actors and comic performers in America, Step and Fetch stuck out. He became a character that I became interested in. And once I found out more about him, it became something that I wanted to do, because it seemed to me that there was a general confusion about who he was, who the character was, and who the man was. And also, I felt that he was unjustly condemned for something that, during his time, was not at all wasn't a negative thing at all. It was something that was expected of black actors, and in fact, it was the only thing that he could do. And in fact, I make constant comparisons to actors today who have an option, and in my opinion, sometimes present acts that are more embarrassing than what Step and Fetch did.
Like Richard Pryor and some of the comics, recent comics that.
But your experience with him is interesting, because he was apparently a very charming, charming man.
Yes, he was, and very prominent, too.
Yes, during the 1930s, again, something pointed out in the book is that Step and Fetch It and Amos and Andy were the among black characters in this country, were the three most famous characters in the country. They're all fictional, of course, because Step and Fetch was Lincoln Perry, and Amos and Andy at that time were being portrayed by two white men.
Yeah.
But those characters were probably the best-known black characters in America. They were national icons, and to a certain extent,
in many people's minds, represented what black life was about, because many people had not even met a real-life black person and were dealing with those characters as being a reflection of what black life was about. That's where the distortion comes in.
And back in Oklahoma at that time, Negro, what we call Negro minstrels, played by white people in blackface, were quite popular.
Yes.
And I had the feeling that Stephen Fetcher was doing a parody on that type of character.
And in one sense, he was. He was taking that caricature and presenting an ironic presentation of it. But that all becomes very, very twisted, because the minstrels had based their comedy, those white minstrels in blackface, had based their acts on blacks that they had seen in the South, and they had distorted that and exaggerated that. Then when blacks came in and were allowed to be entertainers in this country in the late 19th century, they imitated the minstrels, the white minstrels, and exaggerated it more, and it started making fun of the white presentation of what black life was supposed to be. And so, and minstrelsy lasted until the 1960s in this country. They were still white actors or white performers performing in blackface up until the 1960s, until the outcry became such that it's been basically stopped.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate the comments of the caller. I hope she wouldn't mind if I jump in here, because we have some other people I want to get on to. Just very quickly to pick up on the last point, though, when you look at how it is that Lincoln Perry learned his trade, he really came up through minstrelsy. He, as a teenager, out on his own, started performing with traveling tent shows and carnivals, and he eventually worked his way into the black vaudeville circuit, and then from there went to Hollywood. So that was very much a tradition in which he had come up, in which he had learned.
Absolutely. And in fact, that was the only way that black performers could achieve any kind of success at that time. You had to go through that avenue. And every performer that you can talk about from that period came up the same way. That is Bill Robinson, Bojangles Robinson, Eddie Anderson. All of these comics, these actors who became successful actors later, started with minstrelsy, because that was the only way that black performers could get on the stage at that point. They were basically working in tent shows. Some of the more successful ones, like Noble Sissle and people like that, were able to get into theaters by the 1920s, and you had Shuffle Along, the hugely successful show that was on Broadway in 1921 or 22. That show sort of broke the ceiling on black performers, and then blacks started to get into performing on Broadway. But prior to 1922, everyone worked in minstrelsy. Every black performer had to go through minstrelsy.
Let's talk with someone else. In Urbana, line number two. Hello.
Good morning. Yes. I have a question and then I have a comment. Is it possible that he might have traveled to Champaign or Urbana, to one of our old theaters like the Virginia? Could, in your study, did he ever come through this part of the Midwest?
Yes, he did. He worked, in fact, he worked often in that part of the Midwest. And it depends on what time in his career you're talking about. But he worked there early on in his career. But he also lived in Chicago, on the Chicago South Side, with another, with friends of his, a team of comedians who was known as Butterbeans and Susie. He actually lived in their house in on the South Side of Chicago for a while during the 50s and 60s. So that he, and during that time, his stage performances were basically confined to the Midwest. That is, he was performing in Indiana, Iowa, Illinois, and sometimes in Ohio, sometimes up to Toronto. So he performed a lot in that area.
That are detailed enough to know whether or not he came to Champaign-Urbana and where it was that he performed, I guess.
Yes. In fact, in some of the research that I did, there were articles that mentioned his performing in those areas. And some of them are mentioned in the book. Of course, I don't go into every engagement he had.
No, of course not. But when one tours the Virginia Theater, there are comments, and also the Orpheum, there are comments about what actors that we now think of as very important actors were there, and generally comedians coming in on the vaudeville level. And so I was just curious if you happen to know. The other thing is you're adding so much understanding to the stereotypic behavior that he portrayed. It seems to me that a study of one or more of his movies, or films, I guess they'd be called, would be so very important in tracing the changes that have taken place. So rather than certainly my saying, I don't want to see him portraying that type of black, but we didn't call him black at that time.
Right. Negro was the term at that.
But you'd see it as a progression, and it would be a place to compare to now, and so it'd be very valuable. Is it used like that? Do people accept it like that?
Well, that was the intent of the book, to allow people to urge people to look at him in a different way.
Yes.
Simply not to condemn that, because it was it was a product of its time. And as I said, when we had there was an exhibit of Stepan Trečić films at the Museum of Modern Art, and in an introductory talk that I gave there, I urged people to put away their politically correct embarrassment and simply look at this as an example of what America was like at that time.
Absolutely.
And what actors were forced to do. It's a reflection of our country, as far as I'm concerned.
Universal film, university film programs, do they currently, to your knowledge, do any of them use these films? Or is that you're on the avant, and so you hope to...
We're pushing for it now.
In fact,
I'm going to be I'm going out to L.A. Next week, and there's going to be a celebration of Stepan Trečić films and a discussion, a dialogue on black image in films. And so we're trying to get that started, and there are other people who are involved in this, and we're hoping that this can be a lever that allows the public to take another look at that, because it not only reflects on Lincoln Perry or Stepan Trečić, it reflects on what America was, and it shows the progress it has been.
Absolutely. Well, I would think students in film, wherever they're matriculating, would be really informed and really interested in this progression, and it just seems an ideal way to show where we've come. But,
it does.
If people are not open to that, then, of course, they're going to say, no, we don't want to portray.
Well, I've found that there have been some people who have been outspokenly opposed to my even writing the book. There have been some, a minority, but and others are curious, and most are just curious, and others are entirely passionate about what I've done. So,
well, I think your description of the white... of the white minstrels imitating and then the other. And I think that is perfectly fascinating. I mean, that adds such an interesting change and imitation. And it just opens the door, to an understanding of how this all worked out.
Well, the beginning chapters of the book go into that in some detail, and I think you might enjoy them. And also, on my other book, On the Real Side, I go into this in much more detail, because it's not just focused on Stepan Trečić, but it is a fascinating turn of events, a fascinating sense of the evolution of this country, and it seems to me that viewing American society through the prism of humor and entertainment is very revealing, and that's what I was attempting to do.
Well, again, I appreciate the comments of the caller. It's very clear that Lincoln Perry thought that he got a bad rap.
Absolutely.
And not only during his time, but particularly with the kind of criticism that was made, say, in the 60s and beyond. How did he respond? What did he say to those critics? And particularly at the time, there would have been a lot of young African-Americans who were really running him down and, again, as we said, extremely critical of that character. What did he say about that?
Well, he was livid. He was angry at being accused for the negative images of blacks on screen. He voiced his opinion about the fact that that was all that could be done, and the fact that, in fact, he claimed to be a militant and claimed that what he did was very progressive, given what had happened at that time. And to a certain extent, he was right. As I point out in the book, before Stepan Trečić or before Lincoln Perry accepted the role as Stepan Trečić,
whites portrayed blacks in Hollywood motion pictures and feature films. And those portrayals were far more devastating and reprehensible than anything that Stephen Fetchett ever did. In fact, the makeup itself was such that it made these characters look as if they were out of a horror film, not that they weren't real people. So that when he came in and portrayed characters, not in blackface, but as a real human being, it was a step forward in itself. And even though he was still forced to play certain roles and forced to deal with certain stereotypes that Hollywood insisted be in the films, he gradually broke those down. And his own acting ploy, what he called audible pantomime, it was a term he used for it later, that is, taking the lines that were written for him and completely fuzzing them over. In fact, one critic at some point said that he was more stylized than James Joyce and that he could no longer understand what he was saying. And he did this intentionally, and he did it in order to break down and demonstrate a different part of that character that the film industry insisted be portrayed on stage. So that when he argued about this later with other people, he brought this out, he pointed this out. He also became very angry and emotional about the whole thing, and at one point he sort of went almost crazy, I guess, because he started putting down the civil rights movement. He accused the civil rights movement as being driven by foreign interests. He struck back. He was a very angry old man at this point, and he was fighting for his life and what he thought was his legacy. And some of the things he said at that point were off the wall, to be...
Well, and you certainly, I guess, could not blame him for the sense of disappointment, no doubt, that he felt, particularly when you look at the sweep of his life from its highest point to its lowest point.
No, not at all. He was a very disappointed actor because he had constantly fought for and attempted to get the executives at the studio, particularly at Fox Studio, which he worked for most of his life, to allow him a project that put him into a different role, that he wanted to do the life of Satchel Paige, for instance. In fact, he spent a lot of his money in attempting to get that film made. He wanted to do roles that were different than the roles that Hollywood insisted upon. They never allowed him to do that. He wrote several screenplays himself. They were always turned down. There were promises that, yes, you can do this. They would get him back to the studio. And once he went back to the studio, he was again cast as a servant, a comic servant in some role. The fact, though, is that he was making money for them. By this time, Stephen Fetchett, as I said, had become a national icon. He was certainly the best-known motion picture, black motion picture actor of his time, but he was one of the best-known black characters in America at that time.
We have enough time for maybe one more caller, but perhaps two. We'll see what we can do here. We'll go next to someone who is this morning in, I believe, in Champaign, line number 3. Hello.
Yes. My question is, I wonder if you could be as explicit as possible about barriers that he broke, influences that he had, or individuals that he had a direct influence on. Thank you.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, in terms of barriers that he broke, first, as I said, before his appearance in Old Kentucky in 1927, only a handful of black actors had appeared in feature motion pictures from Hollywood. There had been race films, that is, all black films, that were done on low budgets and done by people like Oscar Micheaux and others. But his breakthrough was that he was the first featured actor who was credited in films as on a star level. That was the first breakthrough. Secondly, he often pointed out he was the first black actor to actually kiss a black woman in a motion picture on screen, because, again, the stereotypes at the time were that blacks were either inept comic figures or immoral brutes. So it was a breakthrough to have romance shown between two real black people on screen, which happened in old Kentucky. Next, he was one of the first, in fact, it seems that he was the first, I couldn't pin this down exactly, but he was one of the first black actors to ever work on a contract with a studio. That is, he was paid weekly, something like $2,500 a week at a certain time, whether he worked or not. Up until that time, black actors, when they did work, were being paid per picture, and many of them were making as low as $25 per picture. In fact, even in the 30s, when Willie Best was brought in during one of Stephen Fetch's or Lincoln Perry's absences from Hollywood, Willie Best was brought in and was paid $75 a picture. At the same, at that time, Stephen Fetch, even though he was absent and had walked away from Hollywood, was being paid $3,000 a week. So in terms of just salary and showing that blacks could demand and receive salaries that were somewhat equal to black stars or to white stars, he had made a breakthrough. Also, during his absence in the early 1930s, because he had become such a big star, Bill Robinson, Bill Bojangles Robinson, and Hattie McDaniels received their first roles in motion pictures, in feature Hollywood motion pictures. And to a large extent, it was because he had made the initial breakthrough that they were allowed to be cast in these films. So you have three things right there. The contractual thing, the fact that he was the first black actor to actually portray a feature part, or one of the first black actors to actually portray a feature part in films. Secondly, the contractual aspect. Thirdly, his absence itself, because he'd become so popular, allowed other blacks to be introduced to films. And those black actors, were paid on a higher level than the people that preceded them. So those are the three points right away. I don't think we have time to go into more detail.
Yeah, well, let's talk again with someone else here, someone in Champaign County calling on line number one. Hello.
Hi. There's very little time. There's a couple of resources that I'm sure you're familiar with. Well, the one is the film called Ethnic Notions, which was shown here on campus in the past. I don't know if it has been recently, but it takes these icons from the past. I think maybe a better way to look at it is it's a key to examining the current stereotypes. I don't know that we can applaud how far we've come, as was mentioned in the earlier comment. It's a shame if there is this avoidance of looking at this, because I think it's extremely important to do, and I applaud your work. But this film, Ethnic Notions, just goes through it in a very impactful way. I saw it in Amsterdam, actually, and it was part of an exhibit called Black Over White, which is a study of the icons of European colonialism and relations with Africa. And it was done actually by a sociologist here on campus, Jan Petersen Nederven. And I think academia has been preoccupied with this.
And I think they will. I think that they will become more concerned with it. I think that what's happened, let's put it this way. When the book first came out, there was initially some hesitancy, even on the part of major newspapers. Now, I worked for the New York Times, and they ran the review of this book about a month or 6 weeks after it actually was published. And part of that was a hesitancy to deal with the subject, and other major newspapers have not dealt with it also, and I believe it's part of the same reason. But that is gradually being broken down, and as more people pay attention to the book, more newspapers are now coming out with late reviews. I think that there is this PC or politically correct notion in today's world has something to do with it. But as you're pointing out, I think it's a subject worthy of study. And also, it says, again, something about the society. It tells us as much about Lincoln Perry and motion pictures as it tells us as much about the society as it does about Lincoln Perry and motion pictures.
Well, it could be that it's avoidance of a hard subject as opposed to something coming from, so-called liberals. It could be that it's just, it's a hard subject to deal with. So
when you say hard in what sense?
It just raises all sorts of problems. We have to confront our contemporary situation as well, I would think.
Yeah, and I think that's something that needs to be done. Again, as I pointed out, we talked about earlier, there are people doing acts right now that I personally find more reprehensible than what Stephen Fetch did.
Well that's it. Thank you.
All right, thank you. We're almost out of time. Just real quick, I'm interested because we had a call off the air from someone who said that she was a high school teacher and was interested in maybe showing to her students something that would give them an idea of what Lincoln Perry was all about. Assuming now that you could actually find, go out and find some of his movies, if you wanted to see Lincoln Perry, you wanted to get an idea of what this character was about, what he was like as a performer, is there anything in particular that you would suggest to people to try to look for?
I would suggest one something that is available and is, in fact, one of the best examples of his humor. It doesn't show you what he did in motion pictures, and it's not as quite as embarrassing to younger blacks right now who have never seen him. That is something called Richard's Reply, which is actually a short musical short that's about 12 minutes long that was based on a former comic routine called Open the Door, Richard, which is very popular in the 30s. Stephen Fetcher did a reply to it. He's playing the lazy man character. He has Earl Bostick's band behind him, and it's an example of his act as the world's laziest man, which serves, as far as I'm concerned, as an excellent introduction to what his humor was about. And I would suggest she use that if she wanted to show someone something about him.
All right. And if people would like to read about Lincoln Perry, you can read the book that we have talked about here. It's titled Step and Fetch It, The Life and Times of Lincoln Perry. It's published by Pantheon Books. It's now been out a couple of months. I'm sure you can find it in the bookstore by our guest, Mel Watkins. He's former editor and writer for the New York Times Book Review. Mr. Watkins, thank you very much for talking with us.
You're welcome. And I should also mention they can get that book on Amazon, obviously, on the Internet. So,
Absolutely.
All right.
Again, thank you.
You're welcome.